everyone. This is Sean Duberbeck from Avrio Institute.
And I'm Ross Rubin at Reticle Research.
Thanks so much for joining us for another episode of Techspansive, where this week we will dive into all things Apple. We had both earnings announcements as well as a major event in New York that Ross was at, so he'll be reporting on that for us. We'll talk a little bit about how communication might be changing and the implication that has for some companies, and then we'll look forward to the holidays. We've officially entered November, which gives retailers free rein to talk about Black Friday and start promoting Black Friday. And we saw some of the earliest Black Friday releases for their promotions come out on November 1, Target releasing some of their news already. So we can talk a little bit about that. Let's start with the keynote in Brooklyn and the event in Brooklyn. Ross, I know you were there. Why don't you kick things off for us?
Sure. Right in my backyard. It's not every year that Apple visits the Big Apple. So it was nice to have the opportunity to attend relatively easily. And there were updates to the Mac Mini and the MacBook Air. The MacBook Air had been this popular but neglected child for a long time. It seemed like it had been left behind and really didn't have a place in the world as Apple made the mainstream MacBook very thin and light. But the brand is still a strong brand, and people identify it with a good keyboard and some more ports. And so they've upgraded it. They've really turned the tables there and made the MacBook Air much more compelling again than the regular MacBook. So restoring some luster to that brand, particularly after I think the main MacBook got dinged for a few limitations, such as its keyboard and having only one USB-C port. And they also upgraded a far less popular platform in the Mac Mini, one of their most traditional form factors, and there was a lot of discussion about multiple ports and better cooling. I mean, the kinds of things that you traditionally associate with PCs, desktop PCs. But of course, the real big news were these new iPad Pros that take on more of the aesthetic of the new iPhones. They're not completely edge to edge. I actually like the design of them a bit better than the iPhone because it's nice and consistent across the borders, and there's no notch like there is on the iPhone. So, you know, now that everybody has implemented a notch, maybe we'll see Apple move away from that. We'll see. But really, a couple of my takeaways on the new iPad Pro is that over the past couple of iterations, Apple has really focused on beefing up this platform. They're adding powerful hardware. They've enhanced the operating system so that it multitasks a lot better, handles multiple apps better. And so today, you know, this week, the focus was that they have finally reached some kind of tipping point where they can run desktop quality apps, and they had AutoCAD running with the same engine they run on the desktop. They had Adobe showing off what it called real Photoshop, the implication being, you know, in the past they had some kind of baby Photoshop. And they showed off a console quality video game running at full speed, full resolution, over the very high pixel count of the iPad Pros. You know, given where the iPad Pro pricing starts, I don't think it's any real serious competition to a PlayStation at this point. But, you know, perhaps the Switch has opened our eyes a bit more to the potential of playing games, more sophisticated games on the go. So it seems that, you know, particularly with this keyboard and the pencil now that attaches magnetically to the iPad, it really is looking a lot more like a Surface. And these accessories that they sell are integral to the experience in some ways, certainly a great upsell opportunity for Apple and Microsoft, but brings us back to some notion of modularity that we had in the desktop days. It's a little retro in some respects after all the integration of the laptop and the smartphone.
Well, and the iPad as a category is now almost 9 years old. And so it's interesting to see how it's evolved over time. When it originally launched, it looked like a large iPhone and was criticized because it was a large iPhone. But in fact, what the market showed was that people wanted more screen real estate. And so they really took advantage of that. As a result, you saw smartphones generally come up in size, get bigger, and that has eroded some of the strength of this category and the differentiation of this category. So you saw in Apple's earnings announcements this week that iPad sales were down year over year by about 6%. They sold a little over 9.5 million in the quarter. And so is this enough, do you think, to revitalize this category by taking it into these new areas? And it sounds like those new areas are one, enterprise, and I think maybe the pencil
Absolutely.
Does that. Some of the hardcore software demands can do that. And then also maybe there's a deeper gaming experience that hasn't been had on these devices that now can be delivered.
In terms of the gaming, if you're going to sell these devices into a market of affluent users, of professional users, of course, they're going to have enough disposable income to purchase some games as diversions. But I think you're right, Sean, in that the tablet market is in some ways receding or driving into verticals. And, healthcare is certainly one. This creative professional market, it's one that's had a lot of resonance for Apple and they've had a lot of success there, but it's certainly not a mass market on the scale of what smartphones sell. And this idea that, you're going to include the pencil and you're going to get the keyboard, clearly inspired, I think, by the Surface and a reaction to the needs of those more professional users.
It feels like at the same time, though, we're pushing into this 5G environment, which presumably could mean lighter devices. We could offload more tasks. So devices on the edge of the network, the nodes of the network could be lighter. We talked about in the past this Palm phone that was released today and available today. And that looks a lot like a lighter device on the network, a more scaled down phone, a smaller phone. This week, I actually streamed something to my television using HBO Go, and it was a fabulous experience. And just a few years ago, that would have been a horrible experience. So I could easily imagine wanting a second device in that setting where I'm streaming something to a display and I still want access to the core functions of my smartphone. Maybe it's telephony calls. Maybe it's probably more likely text and messaging, maybe some basic app functionality. And so you could imagine a world pushing in that direction where we've got more smartphone-like devices. The screen real estate is less important because we're pushing it to a bigger display. And really, the hardware is less important as well. So I'd rather have a less expensive device because in a 5G environment, I'm offloading more of the heavy lifting to the network.
You're absolutely going to see lower priced devices, not only to entice users in developing economies to take more advantage of network services, but also as secondary devices in the more mature developed economies. And this week, I also had a conversation with some of the guys behind KaiOS. And if you're not familiar with KaiOS, K-A-I-O-S, it is this new feature phone operating system that Google has invested in. And it is really picking up a lot of momentum. It's in one or two feature, I think it's in one feature phone here in the US. It's in the Reliance messaging phone in India, where it's really taken off. They're expanding into Africa now, and they are looking to move into their first non-smartphone form factor. They're going to be doing an educational tablet with a real focus on web access, but they can deliver it at a lower price point because they really don't need all the hardware support that, say, an Android needs. And these guys definitely recognize the potential of a secondary device like the Palm. But one of the criticisms of the Palm device has been the price at $350. And, you know, that Reliance device on the Jio network in India is, I think, $20. So certainly we'll see higher average prices here in the U.S., but clearly that's a lot of leeway that they can play with under $350.
Well, and it looks like Apple's goal here is to drive to higher price points in a world where unit volumes are slowing. They announced as well during the earnings call that they would stop reporting unit sales in the last couple of years, really, but certainly in the last few earning announcements, they've continued to really emphasize how the stores are doing, how services are doing, highlighting that that's the key areas for growth. In their earnings this week, they talked about relatively flat unit volume in a number of categories. Macs were flat, iPhones were essentially flat, iPads were down. And so you have unit volume down, but then you have average price up. And if you look just at iPhone, for example, you saw that the bulk of the revenue growth was driven from the fact that the average price is up.
Yeah, and I mean, they can do that for the short term. Now, obviously, they're going to hit a ceiling at some point unless they really want to see their market share diminish even further. But the services transition is, I think, going to be a tricky one for them. They have Apple Music today. Pretty much the worst kept secret in the tech industry is that they're working on a video service, although there are a TV service, although there are some rumors that they will create exclusive content for free for Apple device owners. And the hardware business model that they've always had has enabled them to build vertically, right? To create content, services, software that plays off their own hardware, and they can optimize that. If services really becomes more of a dominant business model, then there becomes far more pressure to extend that beyond the relatively limited base of Apple hardware owners. I mean, it's a big base, you know, and they could certainly create some profitable services there. But ultimately, for that to grow, they're going to need to go beyond that. And it's in their interest to do that, not only from a revenue perspective, but from exposing more people to the brand and hopefully getting them into the ecosystem so that they can buy more hardware. But it's tricky to do. Microsoft has had a hard time with it in the consumer market. Apple certainly has a better brand. I think it's going to be a challenging transition.
Well, I would argue that their expertise in the service space is a seamless experience between software and hardware, and that's where they've really focused. And so if services becomes a dominant revenue stream and there's less emphasis on driving overall revenue growth from hardware sales, then you lower the price of the hardware. Maybe those are even loss leaders. So you're subsidizing the price of the hardware, as many retailer, as many consumer electronics manufacturers do. I mean, the Amazon Alexa, for example, probably sells for something below its bill of materials, below its cost, right, when you add in distribution and everything else. And because they're building up that network effect and they're looking to monetize it in different ways. So Apple could do the same thing if services become the dominant revenue stream. You lower the price and you monetize it in a different way. And so that way, in doing that, they would grow the user base. Also, I think they have service opportunities in some of these new categories they haven't touched. So Apple Watch, if it has some fitness services that could be added on, or healthcare, definitely services that could be added on, or if they could subsidize hardware purchases by having insurance pay for the hardware, then that also changes the paradigm significantly. So we could be at a really interesting inflection point over the next, say, 24 months, where we see average prices per unit increasing for the next 24 months, and then we start to see a slow decline over time as services become more dominant, if they do become more dominant, or other individuals are subsidizing the hardware. It was the carriers for a while. Maybe it's the health insurance companies moving forward.
Well, I would just again argue, even in that longer time frame that you're discussing, you know, talking about bringing down ASPs, now you have the opposite problem where Apple has always been a premium brand, and does it impact the luster of the brand, you know, to start seeing things at a very low price point? You know, how many times have we heard Steve Jobs, you know, Tim Cook, others say, you know, we don't make junk. And of course, you know, once you start looking at a subsidized business model, there becomes a lot of pressure to cut costs, to get costs down, because, you know, that's no longer really where you're driving margin. So,
and I would argue this has been their difficulty in entering some of these other markets outside of the US, is because it's very difficult to come up with a premium product at a low price point that is attractive to the Chinese market or to the Indian market. And so they've catered in those markets to individuals who want premium products, and they'll come out with red and gold and other colors that really appeal to those populations. But they're really trying to drive that extreme premium experience in those markets.
And certainly within China, I mean, you have some pretty competitive devices coming out at the top end, just announced in the past few weeks from Huawei and OnePlus. And that's kind of a tale of two brands in itself, where Huawei, of course, facing many obstacles in bringing its phones to the U.S., but OnePlus announcing that it's going to start offering devices on AT&T, but two very impressive smartphones that, you know, I wouldn't say necessarily go head-to-head with the iPhone, but certainly would be competitive for a lot of buyers.
So how important do you think the pencil is when it comes to the device, when it comes to the future of the iPad? And I'm still really skeptical that they'll be able to substantially grow unit volume on a year-over-year basis. So sure, prices will move higher. It will still be attractive to a certain segment of the marketplace. And I look at Mac unit sales that flat year-over-year. They're really not growing the market, at least not right now. They're still catering to a segment of the market that is very dedicated to that, to the Mac experience, but they haven't done a great job of growing it beyond what they've already grown it already.
They do say they're picking up new users. You know, that some, they did mention some percentage of Mac users buying whatever in the past year have been new to the platform. I think maybe a lot of that growth is coming from China, you know, so that same demographic that you mentioned.
Yeah, and I think they will see still some incremental growth in user base, at least in maybe in the Mac universe. But I just don't know how meaningful it will be. And certainly within the iPad category, it's hard for me to see it be meaningfully enough to really change what that category looks like today. They own that tablet category.
Sure,
I would
of
argue.
Course.
There's no market for inexpensive Android tablets anymore. You really don't see them. But I'm still not convinced that that's a category that everyone will want, certainly not in the near future. though the pencil is an interesting take, and that's a different computing experience. So you could argue that maybe this is unique enough, though you could also argue the other way, that styluses really haven't caught on very well in other segments.
Well, putting the stylus aside for a moment, you know, we talked about the form factor changes earlier. Maybe more of that growth. I think the implication is that if the tablet category is going to grow, and they are becoming more and more laptop-like, that really one of the few avenues for them to grow is to cannibalize more laptop sales. And certainly, when the Surface Pro was introduced, you know, Microsoft positioned it directly against the MacBook Air. You know, now they've done their own laptop. But getting back to the pencil, it's I agree. It's not a mainstream accessory. It's certainly, I would consider it foremost an accessory that complements the solution or completes the solution for the creative professional. So if you're creating on this thing, if you're using apps like Photoshop, certainly, or other kinds of painting or drawing apps, sure, it can be a very useful accessory. The other application really is taking notes. And, there's some of that. Microsoft has tried to play into that with Surface Pro, where if you click the button while the thing is asleep, it will take you right into OneNote, and you can start taking notes there. So there, that's an application, but I agree with you. I don't think it's a real compelling mainstream application. I really don't take notes on handwritten notes on computing devices. Certainly if I can avoid it.
Well, and maybe if we got really good at deciphering handwriting, then you might see more of that, maybe in the medical space or in other areas, though it seems like they're jumping straight into voice dictation and then transcribing the notes. And so it seems like that's the direction you'll see in the medical space. So maybe there's some other enterprise applications, but it feels like augmented reality is where you're starting to go in some of the more industrial segments of the economy, so warehousing or manufacturing or some of these others, where they're moving away from having a device in their hand because they want to free their hands for safety reasons and for efficiency reasons. And so I see it fitting into that creative suite, but again, then that's a limited market segment, and it's not clear to me that they'll see strong year-over-year gains in the quarters to come.
I'll say one thing about the pencil in terms of the specific relevance to iPad, which is that it provides a tool that's capable of precision in terms of navigating the interface. It's something that's kind of difficult to do with your fingers, and both the Surface Pro and Android and Chrome OS, all of those operating systems support mice. And cursors, and being able to precisely position elements on the screen. The best way to do that with an iPad Pro is with the Apple Pencil, because you know mice don't work on iPads. iPads don't recognize mice. They don't have cursors. So as we talk about, you know, whether the iPad Pro is ready to take on the mainstream laptop, that is a deficiency that's important to a lot of people.
Sure. Yeah. Well, let's jump to the next category we wanted to talk about, which was the iOS 12.1 update, which enabled FaceTime, group chat. And then at the same time, you have Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook talking about how sharing is shifting to private chat, moving either to messages sent over their Messenger platform or through stories, both on Facebook and on Instagram. You also see Facebook really pushing their portal device. Both we were talking before we started that we both saw advertisements for that and have really seen them try to promote that. What's your take, Ross, on the shifting nature of communication? For example, I obviously can imagine multi-person FaceTime sessions, group chats, being ideally situated to help with homework, students going to FaceTime and being able to connect with not just one student or one peer over a message, but connect with a couple if they were trying to do a group chat and work through a project. So as you see more collaboration taking place in schools, as you see more sharing of documents and presentations, being able to connect over a digital device is a really interesting way. And then you also see what the Facebook is dealing with as engagement among that younger cohort starts to slip and they start to move to some of these other mechanisms for communication.
So the multi, support for up to 32 participants in multi-user FaceTime, first of all, that is a very nice hook into the platform. FaceTime, of course, is a Apple-only technology to extend what we were just talking about. So as opposed to, say, Skype or Hangouts or House Party, which are available on iOS and Android at least. This is an iPhone only application. So if you are part of this peer group in your teens and they're starting this FaceTime group chat, you're left out. You're definitely going to be campaigning more ardently for an iPhone. It has to take place in a platform where the community already is. And FaceTime has resonated strongly, I think, with that teen demographic. And of course, Instagram has just been massive, massive usage. And Facebook, not only have they been introducing this portal device for the video communication that they support on Messenger, but they've also been bringing in more video into Instagram. So it will be interesting to see how far they extend it. But you could certainly see people. I could see people hopping in and out of video chats quickly. It really seems also like something that, as the latency improves, as the network speed improves, that isn't going to seem as much of a interruption, I think, in a 5G world, where it's easy to see how teenagers could be chatting with each other and the video is just there, kind of in the background. Maybe it's passive, maybe it's focused on something else. But I think it is going to become more integrated.
And to your point, I definitely could see those younger cohorts getting involved in that, though they do like the latency that's embedded in a group chat where they can jump in and out of the chat easily.
Do you think the latency is, do they like the delay in time, or do they like the medium of text? Can you separate those out?
Yeah, so I think they like the medium of text, but I think they also like that they can come in and out of the conversation without having mm-hmm. missed any of the conversation. So the conversation is archived if they wanted to go back. It's not clear to me how much they are going back and reading through 1,000 messages, but they have that option too. And they feel like they're part of the conversation because they have the archive on their device. So that's the one thing that video doesn't offer them. It doesn't offer them the recap. But I definitely could imagine teens having it on in the evening when they're doing their homework, and maybe they've got a couple of peers that are working on the same thing, and they just have it on, and they just mm-hmm. have it there, and they'll just pick it up and say, hey, just like they talk to a smart speaker today, they'll say, hey, George, or hey, Peter, Mike, what are you finding for question number 4? And then they might talk about it, and some people will engage and some people will not. So I do think you could see that kind of passive engagement taking place at certain time periods.
And I think that that casts a little bit of a different light on Portal as well, which we discussed in the past quite a bit. The idea behind Portal, of course, is that it's following you around the room, for better or worse. So in this idea of kind of a passive video feed, we're going to have to come up with a cooler word for that. I'm sure the cohort will. You want to be able to stay in the picture, literally. So that's what something like Portal can do today that most smartphone cameras cannot, although to me it doesn't seem out of the realm of probability that something like that would be added in the near future.
I think the idea of fixed cameras is still a really tough one, though, for that sub 18 category. You and I might be more accustomed to jumping in front of a webcam for a web conference or a video chat. That group that's, you know, K through 12, under 18 years old, I think they're used to and more comfortable having the device with them and being able to move that conversation wherever they want to move it. Mm-hmm. And it's akin to when we were kids and we would take the phone and wrap it all the way down the hall and into the bathroom as we sought privacy. They want to be able to duck into the basement, move to their bedroom, move to the porch, move away sure. from the prying ears or eyes of siblings and parents and whoever else might be eavesdropping into those conversations. So, maybe they want it in the living room when they're, or the dining room or in the office when they're working on homework, but then when it comes to something that's of a more personal nature, they want to be able to move that. So that's where I see chat on the phone having a very different experience than chat on a dedicated device. To me, Facebook Portal still looks like the device that you buy your grandparents so that they can communicate with you and check in with you, and it becomes a fixed video experience. And what's nice about that is it does have this easy use functionality and capability. So it doesn't take any steps.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you in terms of its appropriateness for that market. And certainly no one that I can think of has tried this with the scale of resources and user base that Facebook has. That said, that formula, buy something for grandma so she can keep in touch with the grandkids. I've seen a couple of, we've both seen products introduced like that over the years. Tough proposition to make work.
Well, and I think the problem that they're facing is massive, the massive network effects that you need to have in place for this product to work. The first portal is useless, right? Until you can start to connect it with other ones. I mean, that's not entirely
true. Well, it supports to Messenger, right?
Exactly. So it's not entirely true. But the idea is that, and maybe that's the use case scenario, is you have a fixed unit in your parents' house. Well, you've got the portable unit that you're using on your mobile phone. It just feels to me that that's not where people are naturally going. And maybe that will change and maybe that will evolve.
It's a video chat equivalency to what we're seeing happen with voice agents with Siri and Alexa, right? Where they're available on your phone. I set off my little friend here. Where they started off on the phone, and then they decided that there was a place for them in the home as well. But there was more of this kind of ambient imperative than we're seeing on video chat. So
let's rotate to our last topic that we wanted to cover really quickly. We're in November. And it seems like anymore, as soon as we shift the calendars from the 31st to the 1st, we move straight to Black Friday, and retailers are promoting the holidays. We actually had a great employment report today, so the labor market's looking very strong as we head into the final months of the year, and we head into the holiday season, and we head into this clearly important time period around Black Friday. you're seeing, for example, Target already start to talk about some of the deals they'll have. And we're seeing Echo Dots and Google Minis on the cover of many Black Friday circulars and probably more to come. There's a sense that the hype cycle is over for these products, that they had a great holiday season last year, and that's not going to continue. At the same time, it ownership rates are still pretty low across the board. If you look at the average U.S. household, 20-25% of households have them. So you can imagine that more will start to have them. I've seen survey research that suggests 10-15% of households plan to buy a smart speaker over and plan to adopt their first smart speaker over the next year or so. So the holiday season could be a prime time. You and I have talked about how you could use Echo Dots or Google Minis as multi-room audio and be able to push a song to all of the, you know, surround agents that you have throughout the home. What's your take on the holiday season? Is it going to be another good, strong year for smart speakers and smart displays as we start to see, for example, Google Home enter into that space? Or have we really moved on from that and the people who will own it do own it?
You know, I remain a little bit more skeptical on the smart displays for a couple of reasons. The price points, certainly compared to the smart speakers, how much incremental value they're adding. You know, in some ways, do they, and again, we've talked about this, stray from that ambient, focus-free nature of smart speakers? But the Dot and the Google Home Mini, I think it's going to be another strong holiday season for them. There's an opportunity to get a second one, but for another room in the home, I don't think you necessarily need one for every room in the home, but this what we've seen in the past is that we see these kinds of products have a two or three year really strong run over the holiday season, and then, you know, it just sort of bottoms out. We saw it with digital picture frames. We saw it with portable DVD players, where they really become this promotion darling. And then I guess penetration catches up. And then the other thing that's a little bit different with this is that certainly Amazon and Google to some extent are pushing hard to get these agents into you know, just about anything with a plug that you can buy. So given that, the functionality may be entering the home through many different avenues, making the category somewhat redundant. You know, I always thought that this idea of the smart speaker as a separate category was kind of redundant. It was a Bluetooth speaker or a Wi-Fi speaker, and this thing was layered on, just like we're going to see it layered on to many different kinds of products.
Well, and I think you saw their reference case with the microwave when they launched that earlier, that it didn't have a microphone built into it. So you're not speaking directly to the device, but you need a device, an Alexa-enabled device in that room, whether it's a Echo or something else, so that you can direct the microwave to what you want it to do. And so it seems like you're going to need one of these in every room so that you can enable whatever thing is connected in that room, but doesn't have a built-in microphone.
Sure.
You also saw that this year they enabled Spanish. And so I think so, you know, you could imagine that could start to drive adoption as well in certain segments of the U.S. population. And so I think that could really help. I have five or six of these in my house, a mix of Google Minis, Echo Dots, regular Echoes, you know, Google Homes and other things, and could still see a couple of rooms where I need one or two more. So maybe Echo Dot or Google Mini might be a good option.
Is that a holiday gift hint, Sean?
Yeah. Well, I could. So, for example, I have really worked to keep devices out of our kids' bedrooms, and I'm trying to make the steps of keeping it out of my room. So, I've started to use Google Home and Echoes as the alarm clock and as the device for information in those rooms, as opposed to having the screens. And so, I could see wanting to have more of those. And then also in some rooms, I've got both Google Home and Amazon Alexa, because I find that they offer different use case scenarios in certain situations. So to your point, I think there's still a lot of room to see those do very well at low price points. $25, they become stocking stuffers or small gifts. I could imagine that we'll continue to see that grow. And as the use case scenarios have grown, as the skills have grown, then you could start to see that happen as well, start to see growth there as well.
Well, one thing that I think the new Google Home Hub makes a stronger effort at addressing is the skill discoverability. So, you know, they have several screens giving examples of the kinds of things you can say. What good are the skills if you can't find them? So it's certainly a challenge for Amazon, and the devices with the screens absolutely provide a richer opportunity to expose the skills. That's certainly in the interest of the ecosystem, the device providers. And I guess you could maybe argue that it's in the interest of the consumer as well, because it allows them to get more utility out of what they've purchased.
Oh, I definitely think that is a massive hurdle for 2019. You've gotten adoption up significantly and will drive incremental adoption and greater density over the holiday season. And then as you move into 2019, skill discoverability becomes a key hurdle. I think what you see the manufacturers working on, Google, Amazon, others, is getting greater adoption of the APIs into whatever you're producing. So they want to see it in everything, and they've really focused there. But I think from a service experience and a consumer experience, you really need to focus on that discoverability. And they do it with weekly emails and other things like that. But I think to be able to do it from the device, when somebody asks Alexa something or asks Google something, Google can respond with, hey, I don't have the answer, but there is this skill that you might be interested in, and being able to promote those and recommend those will be key. And I would argue Apple's done a great job of that in the App Store, of recommending and highlighting what's trending and other things like that. And the smart speakers should take a page from their book on how to promote and that app environment or that skill environment.
And again, the Echo Show does some of this in sort of its screensaver mode, or when you wake it up, by suggesting different kinds of things you can say. But again, maybe those are relevant to you, maybe they're not. The idea that you might assume that an agent can address something in your home, and you issue that command, and you know it may respond saying, I can't do that. You're going to have to add the refrigerator skill, or you know, the washing machine skill. That just, you know, destroys the whole flow. So it's not just discoverability, but it's improving the installation process.
Yeah, the seamlessness.
Yeah, I agree.
Good. Well, that is a wrap for us. Ross, always great to talk with you and walk through some of these trends. I know next week I will be in Chicago speaking at AFP on Monday. So if you're there, definitely stop by and say hello. And then on Tuesday, I'll be in Indianapolis speaking to the Association of General Contractors there. And so if you're in Indy, definitely say hello as well.
And I will just be hanging out on Twitter. I'm looking forward to the Samsung Developer Conference. A lot of excitement about potential folding phone news. So maybe we can address that in a future episode. I won't be attending, but I'll be tuning in to live streams as best I can. And you can find me on Twitter at Ross Rubin.
And I'm Sean Dubrovac. You can find me on Twitter at Sean Dubrovac. Definitely tune in next week for our next episode of TechSpansive.